Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, the podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. The publication of Torquato Tasso's Gerusalemme Liberata in 1581 occasioned a host of responses from artists, literati, and musicians that lasted well into the 18th century. In this lecture, recorded on February 25, 2015, Peter Lukart focuses on the rich corpus of drawings, paintings, and prints created during the first decades after the epic became part of the shared culture of Italy. From lavishly illustrated editions of Tasso's poem to handsomely decorated interiors, the text provided a rich source of narrative material for painters, draftsmen, and printmakers. The lecture concludes with an introduction to Claudio Monteverdi's 1624 musical representation of a famous scene from Gerusalemme, Il Combattimento di Tancredi e Clorinda, in which the intersection of love and war has tragic consequences.
Because this talk will not include an exhaustive introduction to Torquato Tasso's Gerusalemme Liberata, I wanted to make a few broad points before I begin. First, Tasso wrote and revised his epic poem between the 1560s and the early 1580s, largely within the court of Ferrara. Centered on the First Crusade undertaken by European, that is, Christian forces, to liberate Jerusalem from the hands of the Muslims in the 11th century. Tasso devised a work of 20 cantos of varying lengths, and each is made up of many octaves, and octaves are hendecasyllables rhyming in a pattern of ABBA, ABBA. And in the course of reading the Gerusalemme, one encounters the Catholic commander Godfrey of Bouillon, or Goffredo in Italian, and his principal warriors, such as Tancred and Rinaldo, as well as Aladino, the king of Jerusalem, and his Muslim officers, and several Muslim women, some of whom take up arms, such as Clorinda and Erminia, as we shall see, and some of whom weave their magic and their treachery both on and off the battlefield, such as the sorceress Armida. As Laudo Benedetti informed us at that first lecture, one of the great strengths of Tasso's epic is that he does not characterize his protagonists as unidimensional. Both Christians and Muslims display heroism and cowardice, kindness and cruelty. And when they are faced by the grave choices of love or war, we cannot help but be swept up in their timeless struggles. Having fought with censors for years, upon the publication of Gerusalemme Liberata in 1581, Torquato Tasso had a bestseller on his hands. Not only was his epic poem immediately famous and printed in multiple editions, it had been published in his lifetime with commentary and, soon thereafter, with illustrations. This trifecta was analogous to getting the movie deal for an early modern writer. The illustrated editions both acknowledged and expanded the author's renown. At the same time, Tasso's Gerusalemme became the subject of withering criticism from his contemporaries, most damningly from members of the Accademia della Crusca in Florence. Here, in fact, we see a response to that criticism by one of his champions, who is Lorenzo Giacomini, a member of the Accademia degli Alterati in Florence. But even Galileo weighed in against Tasso. Yet this critical discussion, however unsettling to Tasso personally, also served to trumpet the fame of the poet. We also witnessed the significance of Tasso's success reflected in the jealousy of other poets of the period who hoped to embark on a similar course to renown. Tasso's contemporary, Gabriello Cibrera, for example, wrote to the artist Bernardo Castello, who had sent him a copy of the 1590 edition of the Gerusalemme that he had illustrated, and this is Cibrera's commingled thoughts. For the gift of this book, I offer infinite thanks, for I see in it excellent figures of poetry and painting. I, who have great affection for Tasso, hold this book in my hands at every hour, and thus at every hour I will be in the presence of your affection and your genius. But about your compliments for my Amidiadi, which is one of the poems that he was working on at the time, I thank you for the sweet inducement to write poetry. Nonetheless, I could not hope to accomplish it, nor even if I could accomplish it, could I hope to achieve such an honor, or more precisely, I could not accept it, being that I am by nature an enemy of presumption. This is all Quebrada responding. Evidently, Quebrada got over his aversion to presumption, for about a decade later, he wrote to Castello to ask for the frontispiece for the Immediati. And are we surprised to talk about the details of the illustrations for his epic poem, which was only published in 1620. And I open with this anecdote in order to make several points. First, that Tasso's Gerusalemme was a text beloved by literati and artists from the moment it was first published. Second, that poets and painters had occasion to correspond with one another. And third, that poets and painters took inspiration from one another. Further, and related to this last, the special relationships that develop between artists and poets often result in some of the most interesting and influential collaborations in our shared culture. And I will be talking today first about the visual representations of Gerusalemme, and we will end with the musical representation in the Combattimento. Now, such was the case for Castello, who was introduced to Tasso in 1576, after Gerusalemme had been completed, but before it was first published in 1581. In May 1586, Tasso wrote in a letter that Castello had passed through Ferrara on his way back from Venice and left with him a series of drawings relating to my poem. Though it is doubtful whether these particular drawings, now bound in a volume housed in Palermo, are the works in question, we do know that similar ones initiated a cordial friendship. More importantly, these exchanges cemented the decision to have Castello's drawings included in a new luxury edition of the Gerusalemme, published in Genoa by Girolamo Bartoli in 1590. We do not have detailed critical responses from Tasso, but in a letter to their mutual friend, Don Angelo Grillo, he spoke frankly about the process of recreation and co-creation. With regard to my book, I have not changed my opinion. It would not be necessary to change many of the figures by Castello, who is faster at creating the drawings than I am at dealing with them. Nonetheless, his drawing must be similar to the idea that I have envisioned for it. Although there is a slight sense of reprimand in Tasso's statement because Castello was getting ahead of him in the production of illustrations, by and large, Tasso liked the figures and the artist's conception of the scenes to be illustrated. The existence of these fragmentary notes suggests that Tasso and Castello conducted a frequent and candid correspondence, now sadly largely lost. This letter bespeaks an intimate and informed collaboration between the poet and the artist that began in earnest in 1586 and continued at least through the publication of the Bartoli edition in 1590. Furthermore, it points to the centrality of the Genoese literary and artistic culture in the publication of early editions of Tasso. For it was in Genoa, too, that the physician and literary scholar Giulio Guastavini wrote his Annotazioni, and that is translated into English as commentaries, on the Gerusalemme, which helped to redirect the argument about Tasso's place in the literary pantheon from that of rival to his contemporary Ariosto to that of rival of the ancients, Homer and Virgil. Together, Castello, Guastavini, and publisher Bartoli increased Tasso's fame throughout Europe. On a recent trip to Genoa, I examined two examples of the first edition that they have at the Biblioteca Laberio, one of which has notes. You see that with the arrows pointing at the very top from the editor showing that the plates had been flipped for cantos 4 and 5. This is an absolutely unique edition, and it has many notes throughout the text. I'm going a little bit off script here to tell you that this is well worth visiting the various editions to see what kinds of annotations and marks they have. You never know what you might find there. And in addition, in looking at this edition, the sharp details and rich inking of this advanced copy give us some sense of what was originally intended for the Gerusalemme. Most of us have seen examples that are far later in the printing from the plates. We are fortunate to have an excellent copy of the 1590 edition close at hand in the Rosenwald Collection of the Library of Congress, from which I will highlight several illustrations. From Canto 7, Erminia and the Shepherds, Erminia, who is pursued by Christian soldiers while disguised in Clorinda's armor, loses her way in the wilderness and follows the sound of pipes to find a shepherd and his three young boys, and thereby temporarily exchanging the battlefield for a pastoral idol. From Canto 12, Clorinda dying in the arms of Tancred, and this will be our touchstone throughout the lecture, Clorinda is a warrior for the Muslim forces. Tancred is one of the most heroic of the Christian soldiers. They encounter each other at least three times in the epic. And we'll talk more about this as we go along. And from Canto 16, Armida, the enchantress, uses her wiles to keep the Christian warrior Rinaldo on the enchanted island. And it is not until Rinaldo's comrades in arms, Carlo and Ubaldo, arrive that the spell is broken, and Rinaldo returns to combat. Here we see Rinaldo and Armida in mid-embrace with Carlo and Ubaldo in the foreground. In focusing on these three scenes, some patterns emerge. First, that every print has a different episode in each plane, foreground, middle ground, and background. Castello's drawings, later engraved by Giacomo Franco and Agostino Carracci, use repoussoir figures and features, as well as light, to direct the reader-viewer's attention from plane to plane. In this way, Castello economically but effectively encapsulates an entire canto in a single image. Second, the visual narrative thus serves as a kind of analog to the argomento, which collapses all the action into a single ottava rima, which is meant to introduce each new canto. However, the prints, to my mind, really encourage the reader to linger over the many plot threads, characters, and their emotional states, as well as the landscape and architecture. Coming at the beginning of the canto, they provide a preview and synopsis of the action on the first reading before one is familiar with the text, and on subsequent readings, they become something to savor, along with or independently of Tasso's poetry. Furthermore, you have undoubtedly already noticed that there are repeated positions of the bodies that help to reinforce parallel themes in the epic, and that the artist uses a similar shorthand to indicate the walls of Jerusalem, the forest, the race or religious persuasion of the figures shown, and the battleground or other details. Castello picks up on Tasso's leitmotif of romantic love and expresses it through physical proximity in the form of figures lying on the ground, one of whom cradles the other in his or her arms. In Canto 12, Clorinda dying in the arms of Tancred, after having battled with Clorinda in full battle armor, at last Tancred recognizes his beloved when her helmet is removed. Although not shown, just a few moments later, as Clorinda is about to expire, she asks to be converted to Christianity, and Tancred obliges. Baptizing her with water, he pours from his helmet. We'll see scenes of all this in the ensuing slides. For the time being, however, Castello underlines the reawakening of passion between the star-crossed lovers. In the middle ground, we see the flaming war machine that Clorinda had set ablaze prior to the fateful battle against Tancred and the Christian troops. This action, which Clorinda defiantly confesses to Tancred, ultimately enrages him and leads to her own death at his hand. And in the background, the intact walls of Jerusalem, with bolted gates, remind us that the city is still not liberated. Similarly, in Canto 16, Castello is one of the first to depict the Christian hero Rinaldo in the arms of the enchantress Armida, at the moment highlighting the reciprocity of gazes described by Tasso, with Armida looking blankly into the mirror Rinaldo proffered, and Rinaldo lost in the mirror of his beloved's eyes. In the right foreground, Carlo and Ubaldo, who have resisted the charms of the sirens, approach to rescue their companion Rinaldo from Armida's enchantments and return him to his proper place with the Christian troops. In the background, on a slight promontory, sits the circular castle that belongs to Armida and locates us on her island far from the battlefield. As a point of comparison, Annibale Carracci's Rinaldo and Armida of about 1601 also focuses principally on the embrace and the exchange of glances and reflections. Armida's castle, however, and suggested by a single arcade behind the lush garden, which serves also to frame the heads, if you look in that blue square, of the nearly hidden soldiers Carlo and Ubaldo. Beginning about 1612, Costello began lobbying for a third edition, for which he wanted to solicit funding from Carlo Emanuele I, Duke of Savoy and Turin. It took 5 years and much negotiation, as we learn from the correspondence with Chiabrera, who was living there at the time and serving as Costello's advocate. In the end, the title page to the new edition states that the book was published at the behest of Costello himself. However, he wisely dedicated it to Carlo Emanuele and with funding received from the Savoyan ambassador in 1616. Yet the publication went forward with new argumenti by Orazio Ariosti and all new illustrations drawn by Costello and engraved by Camillo Cunjo. In comparison with the 1604 edition, which I am not illustrating, this version was more luxurious, with a much larger page size that gave the poem and the illustrations more breathing room. And unlike the 1590 edition, each image is surrounded by a frame based, it appears, on Serlio's designs for theater. For Canto 12, our touchstone for this lecture, Costello chose to depict an odd scene I have not found elsewhere, Tancred and Clorinda being carried off the battlefield. In fact, if one does not look closely at the print, it is easy to miss the swelling breasts of Clorinda, which could lead possibly to gender confusion and misidentification. Further, it is not an episode mentioned in Ariosti's summary, and it reminds us that both Tancred and Clorinda were injured, the latter mortally, and that the moment of realization of the identity of his combatant happens only after the fatal blow is struck. Most unusually, Costello chose not a heated moment of the warriors locked in combat, nor the tender scene of Clorinda's death and conversion, but the post-mortem episode when the wounded Tancred is carried back to his encampment and the now dead body of Clorinda is removed from the forest so that she will not be consumed by wolves, but buried, we assume. To this point, we have focused on Costello's contributions to the early promulgation of Tasso's Gerusalemme, but the first to undertake illustrations that we know, never published, was the Ferrarese artist Domenico Mona, about 1580. Produced in Ferrara at the very moment that the first edition of Tasso's epic was being published, they suggest another dialogue between artist and poet concerning the selection of the most interesting scenes from the various episodes. Mona's drawings were found in a manuscript version of Gerusalemme that included the argomenti of Orazio Ariosti again, who was the ostensible owner. Tasso, Ariosti, and Mona were friends, and this manuscript suggests also collaborators. For Canto 3, Mona chose the second encounter of Clorinda and Tancred in front of the ramparts of Jerusalem, after Tancred had struck Clorinda with his lance and dislodged her helmet. This scene allows the viewer to identify Clorinda, whose head and features would otherwise have remained obscured. As we shall see, this was not the last meeting of the two star-crossed lovers, though the elements were all laid out as foreordained. In full battle dress, Clorinda will again be disguised from Tancred, and the revelation of her identity will quickly change the course of his heart. For Canto 12, Mona selected not the combat of Tancred and Clorinda, nor the subsequent conversion of Clorinda. Rather, he focuses on the part of the narrative in which her guardian, Arsette, recounts Clorinda's lineage as the daughter of Senapo, thought to have been one and the same with Prester John in Ethiopia, and this is the first mention that, though raised a Muslim, she was born to Christian parents. And for Canto 16, Mona chose not the episode that captured the imaginations of countless later artists, that is, Rinaldo dallying in the arms of Ermida, but the moment when the lovers return to their duties in the war. Rinaldo accompanies Carlo and Ubaldo in the boat captained by Fortune. And in a brilliant elision of Tasso's text that highlights both the billowing sails and Fortune's, quote, tresses waving in the gales, the golden sail o'er surging ocean speeds. In this case, Fortune's hair literally becomes the sail. This is a detail that few other artists notice or intuit. I wanted to show briefly another version of a similar moment as depicted by the Emilian artist Sisto Badalocchio, so that you can observe the more typical means of representing the boat with the proper sail not yet unfurled. Armida has here collapsed in grief at Rinaldo's decision to depart, and at the far end of Badalocchio's ship, Fortuna's hair blows in one direction and her drape in another. In this first close reading of Mona's drawings, Rensselaer Lee found that they provide testimony to Tasso's own battle with the Inquisition. There are no scenes of love or tenderness, rather illustrations of moral severity, battles and tactical deliberations, or Christian triumphs. I would qualify that blanket statement by adding that Mona does suggest the reawakening of love between Tancred and Clorinda. In Canto 3 again, albeit on the battlefield. It is equally true that many of the episodes that Mona selected are not pursued by any subsequent artist. Does that reflect Mona's personal preferences or Tasso's? I have concentrated on the graphic representations of Gerusalemme because they were often the first ones produced and in many ways the most influential to the artists who followed. Not only did a significant number of artists own the illustrated editions of Tasso, which provided rich visual detail, they were undoubtedly responding to the argomenti and the privileging of particular scenes by the commentators and illustrators. Among the first of the painted responses to Tasso is a powerfully foreshortened view of the conversion of Clorinda by Domenico Tintoretto. Having fought through the entire night, Tancred and Clorinda are seen just as dawn is breaking in the background. Tintoretto augmented the terrestrial light with the dazzling heavenly vision of two seraphim accompanying the dove of the Holy Ghost, like an exclamation point on the Counter-Reformation themes inherent in Tasso's epic, though not described by him. That turns the plants a golden hue. Together, the raking angle of the figures and the strong light draw our attention to all the details of Tasso's verses, the ashen face, quote, like violets mixed with lilies, and the mortal wound of Clorinda from whence blood has stained her blouse on one hand, and the swiftly running Tancred, and you see that in his extended left leg if you look closely, who arrives with the water for her baptism at the precise moment that she is about to die. By contrast, Sisto Badalocchio orients the scene parallel to the picture plane and draws us in with the brilliant light that bathes Clorinda's bare and bloody chest. Although we can again see dawn breaking in the distance, Clorinda, having declared her conversion and receiving baptism from the hand of Tancred, herself appears to glow. There is no heavenly apparition, rather a more naturalistic or verosimile interpretation. Yet this internally generated light beatifies Clorinda, who looks more like a martyred saint than a dying heroine. Similarly, Badalocchio sets his narrative in a verdant landscape far from the walls of Jerusalem, which we can only glimpse in the far background. At the same time, the counter-reformatory message is balanced by the tender clasp of their proper left hands and the ambiguity of their gazes. Whereas Tancred concentrates on the act of baptism, Clorinda looks lovingly at him and not towards heaven. Of the other scenes highlighted in Castello's prints, we find that artists of the period frequently depicted the pastoral subject of Erminia and the shepherds. Time is fleeting, but I did want to make certain that you would see the clever reimagining of the episode as a family portrait by Santi di Tito in the late 16th century. Here the mother is Erminia, the father a shepherd, and the three children are the pipers. In addition, the National Gallery of Art is fortunate to have two grand 18th century panels from a Venetian palace by Antonio and Giovan Francesco Guardi, depicting on one, Erminia and the shepherds, and in the other, Carlo and Ubaldo resisting the enchantments of Armida's nymphs. They are found in the grand staircases leading up from the 6th Street entrance, which I call to your attention so that you can admire them on your next visit to the galleries upstairs. I also want to recommend to you the insightful monograph of Jonathan Unglaub on Poussin and the Poetics of Painting. I don't have time to go into great detail about this, but I do encourage you to read it if you are more interested in looking at it in absolutely first-rate and significant review of Poussin's reading of Tasso. However, I feel that there are more heroes than Poussin in the history of images after Tasso's Gerusalemme. Unglaub's great contribution is the interpretive lens he has found to isolate the literary and visual materia that inform the depiction of Tasso's epic. And in his penetrating analysis of Poussin's Dulwich, Rinaldo and Armida, which we're looking at here, for example, he calls our attention to the French painter's deliberate sparseness in depicting a barren landscape and a single figure of Eros, the better to focus our attention on the moment when love literally restrains Armida's hand from plunging a dagger into Rinaldo's chest. And in Unglaub's word, only love has the power to disarm hostility. But our focus today is really on Tancred and Clorinda. And in that regard, I would like to turn now to one of the grandest early responses to Tasso's epic, which was found not in Italy, but in France, though the patron was the Italian-born queen Marie de' Medici, who married Henri IV in 1600. In the Cabinet de la Reine at Fontainebleau, Marie commissioned Ambroise Dubois to paint a suite of canvases about 1601 to 1606 on themes taken from the Gerusalemme. Not surprisingly, all of the episodes selected concern female protagonists, Clorinda, Sophronia, and from Heliodorus' novel, an Ethiopian story, also Chariclea. Foremost among these large-scale paintings is the combat. This is, in fact, the second combat, not to be confused with the one we will see in the opera. This bears comparison to the composition of Mona's drawing from Canto 3. Instead of that nonviolent meeting, Dubois has chosen the heat of battle, where the two lovers, unknown to one another, despite being only sparsely covered with armor and wearing revealing helmets, are about to wield their unsheathed swords. Since this is a painting cycle and not an illustrated book, the artist and patron freely select which cantos to highlight and which scenes to depict. Here we find not only the combattimento, but also the rarely represented scenes of the birth of Clorinda, which is now lost, Tancred and Clorinda at the fountain from Canto Primo, and this is the first moment when Tancred's love blossoms. He has here not identified her as Clorinda, but rather as La Pagana. And we also see Tancred in front of the walls of Jerusalem, Clorinda before Aladdin, which I don't have a slide for, and Dubois also depicted the conversion of Clorinda from Canto 12. Moribund, Clorinda leans back on her shield as Tancred prepares to pour water from his helmet onto her brow. In the middle ground, Dubois shows an early moment when Tancred dips his helmet. I think I can show that a little bit here. That he's out here dipping his helmet in the stream. This is the most complete cycle of Tancred and Clorinda, and I bring it to your attention for its relevance to Monteverdi's Combattimento, as there is nothing comparable in Italian art at the period. But if Monteverdi's intervention is more like a musical explication de texte, Dubois is a visual concordance in which nearly every scene where Tancred and Clorinda appear is brought to life. Unlike Dubois' cycle, Monteverdi drew his entire text from Canto 12, octaves 52 to 62 and 64 to 68, which you should have in a reproduction there, which will help you with the video. In addition to allowing the composer to maintain the unities of time, space, and action, the selection of episodes provided a strongly pro-Christian, anti-Turk, or anti-Muslim message for the Venetian audience gathered for a performance of the Combattimento in the palace of Girolamo Mocenigo, the Proveditore of the Venetian state in 1624. Tasso's fertile poetry offers many opportunities to artists and composers. They saw different things or inflected different actions or emotions within the same text. For example, Monteverdi's libretto for the Combattimento omits the final scene of the transport of Tancred and Clorinda to the Christian camp. which we saw earlier, again by Costello. And Costello emphasizes the movement of the figures from one field to the next, closely following Tasso's text. Monteverdi chooses to preserve the Aristotelian unity of plays, and thus has the conversion and death of Clorinda occur on the battlefield. Monteverdi chooses a narrator, whom he calls Testo, thus the text becomes a real character in the opera, as well as two principal actors, and brings us into the scene in medias res. The combattimento was written in what Monteverdi called the genere rappresentativo, by which historians of music believe he meant a theatrical mode. Before the original performance, which occurred about 1624 to 25 in a private residence in Venice during the season of Lent or Carnevale, the first audience had no clue that they would witness a spectacle. They were enjoying the diversions of a soiree with strolling musicians and conversation. The characters entered, and this is coming somewhat directly from Monteverdi, unexpectedly during the performance of madrigals. Clorinda in armor, followed by Tancred on a cavallo mariano. And this term has variously been interpreted as a kind of caparisoned hobby horse emblazoned with symbols of the Virgin, or possibly as a typo for cavallo marino, or seahorse. Personally, I would love for it to be the latter. A seahorse would make a setting for an opera in a Venetian palazzo that much more marvelous. Monteverdi's own description in his eighth book of madrigals of Love and War speaks volumes about his intentions and the reception of the first performance. And I'd like to quote from that as I'm concluding. "They will perform steps and gestures in the way expressed by the oration, nothing more or less, observing diligently those measures, blows, and steps, and the instrumentalists will perform sounds excited and soft, and Testo delivering the words and measure in such a way that the three actions come to unite in a unified imitation. Clorinda will speak when appropriate, Testo silent, and similarly Tancred. The instruments, that is, four viole da braccio, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, and a contrabasso da gamba, which continues with the harpsichord, should be played in imitation of passions of the oration. Testo's voice should be clear, firm, with good delivery, somewhat distanced from the instruments, so that the oration may be better understood. He must not make gorghe or trilli, that is, the ornamentation. He didn't want elaborate ornamentation for the narrator, except in the stanza which begins notte. And when it was performed here, I'll just make an aside, it was so beautifully done in the concert on exactly that note. It's incredibly ornamented. For the rest, however, he will deliver the words according to the passions of the oration. In this manner, now 12 years ago, it was performed in the palace of the most illustrious Signor Girolamo Mocenigo. My particular lord, with all refinement, given that he is a knight of excellent and delicate taste, and in carnival time, since it was an evening pastime, in the presence of all the nobility, who remained moved by the emotion of compassion in such a way as almost to let forth tears, and the audience applauded it for being a song of a kind never before seen, never before heard." And I want to give thanks here to the author, Tim Carter, for his translation of Monteverdi's words, and to my colleague, Elizabeth Cropper, for her reinterpretation of that last sentence. I'll talk about that in the commentary if you care to hear more about that. Monteverdi's Combattimento introduced many novità, or novelties, to musical performance. It is said to be the first instance of the use of pizzicato and tremolo in the strings, which together added more agitation and excitement to the singing in what he called his stile concitato, or aroused mode. In fact, the instrumentalists and the singers often act independently of one another. There is much more to be said about Monteverdi's great achievements in this rarely performed opera, but I don't want to defer your pleasure much longer. The presentation in the video will make things clearer than any exegesis could hope to do. And finally, it is important to remember that the first performance of the Combattimento came as a complete surprise to all in the audience. Perhaps these two reimaginings of the Combattimento, one from the 17th century, this one by Giovanni Bilibert that shows Tancred mourning over the dead Clorinda. It's an unicum, as far as I know, to have the naked body of Clorinda after she's dead, and Tancred wounded with his bloodied shirt behind her. And one from the 21st century. I'm hoping these will serve a kind of similar purpose to put you off balance. Here we see President Obama as Tancred, an unidentified woman in makeshift armor as Clorinda, and the Secret Serviceman with an earpiece is Testo. Badalocchio's Tancred and Clorinda is now on the screen again because I want to conclude with just a word about the first performance. Talking, laughing, dancing, and certainly gambling, Monteverdi drew the raucous guests into a single focused activity. In keeping with the poetic and artistic conventions of the period, the rappresentazione played shamelessly on the affects or emotions of these spectators. The problem for Monteverdi was communicating sympathy for the protagonists when they have so few lines. Thus, the testo is charged with filling in all the details of action and narrative tissue. Meanwhile, the instrumentalists are heightening emotions and painting sound pictures that provide a physical setting for the actors. When Clorinda, newly baptized, draws her last breath and sees heaven opening before her, the audience is expected to be overcome with emotion. In Tasso's treatise, Dell'arte Poetica, he stated that the poet's role is to move the reader to, quote, anger, pity, or terror, to joy or sadness. The original audience wept not just because of Monteverdi's music and stagecraft, but because they already knew Tasso's Gerusalemme so well. It was the startling re-presentation of Tasso's poetry in Monteverdi's aroused manner, the Concitato Genere, within a theatrical production, in an unexpected setting, that caused them to experience the epic in a new way. And I hope that your encounter, whether the first or the 21st, will now be similarly informed. Thank you. And now I have a very brief introduction to the video that we're going to switch to. It runs just about 20 minutes, so if anybody is in need of getting back to an office or leaving for the day, please don't worry. You will not offend anyone here. It's just 20 minutes, quite interesting, a 1993 production by the Netherlands Opera. And I chose it because it was performed in costume with period musicians, as Monteverdi indicated, who are off stage, and three principals on stage. That is Testo, played here by Guy de May. He sings and emotes as Tancred, played by Martin Koningsberger, and Clorinda, Lorna Anderson, act out the narration. They only sing when Tasso has supplied them with dialogue, when they challenge each other to fight over, it says in the text, they say war or death, and he says, Clorinda responds, both. So she's ready to go at it. And when Tancred begs his opponent to name him or herself, she confesses only that she burned the Christians' war machine, as we saw in the illustrations, and that further angers Tancred. Battle ensues. And finally, the recognition of the dying Clorinda, who forgives Tancred and asks for his baptism, her baptism as a hand. Tancred's interior dialogue at that moment is voiced by Testo, because according to Tasso, Tancred at this moment is stupefied. He is mute and motionless. And in the narration of Testo, it says, "Ai vista, ai conoscenza," in this early 17th century translation as, "Ah, unhappy sight, ah, woeful knowledge," as he has removed the helmet of Clorinda and realized that he's killed his lover. And as the piece closes, Clorinda bids, "Farewell, I die in peace." And again, you have the libretto in front of you if you want to follow the Italian. I'm happy to answer questions at the end of the video if anybody wants to stay on, and to do so informally at a later point if you can't stay. Thank you.
Credi che Clorinda nuovo posti, vuol nell'armi provar.
Thank you. stella il raggio langue sul primo albor che in orienti acceso vegetan credi in maggior copia sangue del suo nemico e se non tanto offeso ne gode e insuperbisce nostra folle mente di fortuna e scolle misero di che godi ormai domesti siano i trinolfi infelice il vanto
Yes. cerubella in vita fu, ma vol in morti
la fine di la colonna.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.